And once again, to bring our good friend David Terachuk in, David's website is themediabeat.us. He responded for he joins us on a weekly basis, especially if I'm not sick or anything like that. David, nice to have you along with us today. And I do have a question to pose to you about media coverage right off the bat.
Well, let me just do our usual introduction because I want to say that I'm really glad to be to be joining the sharp-eyed Marshall Miles again. Not sick any longer, and I'm glad to hear about recovery. But here I am reporting in once more from the media capital of the world, New York City. What was the question?
Well, I've been following SpaceX for a while, and I watched this morning live when it went up. And the funny thing is I considered, like, if people remember the early days of NASA, the things that exploded when they were practicing, and most of the media labeled it a failure because it exploded. I think you only learn to have safe rockets by having them go up and test them and blow up. And I wish that was more the angles that some of the media would take in this.
Well, certainly, SpaceX's chief executive, we don't actually have to name him, do we? He's just the
No.
richest man in the world. But he was very careful to tamp down any media expectations ahead of time. He seemed to suggest that there might well be one or two, or maybe even three attempts at putting this big new Starship rocket up. And sure enough, he was there ready to pounce on this, say that this is a learning experience. I mean, it's true that SpaceX, in throughout its pretty short life, when it started without having the huge sort of bankrolling capital fund that it now has, it can write that record off, that rocket off pretty comfortably in financial terms. But even when it was a scrappy little company without a great deal of reserves, they established early on a kind of mantra for themselves, which was to fail fast but learn faster. And of course, the whole business is you're supposed to learn from your failures, and never is it more true, I guess, in space flight. I mean, there have been some terrible, costly in human terms as well as financial failures along the way for NASA as well as SpaceX. But we're not talking about that kind of league of disaster now. It's an explosion, yes, and I'm sure they would have preferred it not to have happened at all, but they were certainly ready for it. And I think the sensible media are perfectly well aware of that. But at the same time, he's not going to get the unnamed CEO in this venue anyway. He's not going to get a totally free pass. He's going to be reminded that he's capable of failure as well as success.
I want to switch things over to the trial against Fox News by Dominion. And of course, Fox News will have no problem paying the tab on that. But the thing that that I find interesting is I think that this Dominion suit against Fox clearly opens up for everybody else that was involved, not only with Dominion, but the other companies. They're clearly now a precedent to go after everybody. And look at even what happened with the announcement today of the MyPillow CEO. He was ordered to pay through a $5 million payment because he bet $5 million that nobody could debunk his false election data. I think this is going to lead to some serious consequences for the other people that don't have the billions of dollars that Fox has.
Sure, I think it's a vastly significant development. I mean, we kind of joke that I'm coming from the media capital of the world, but this week you might have been forgiven for thinking the media capital of the world has shifted to Wilmington, Delaware. Certainly, the biggest legal case concerning the mass media in decades was due to happen there. And the world's media, of course, descended in their hordes on the Delaware Superior Court. And as you say, it didn't happen that way, and there was a great deal of drama about delays and such like. But the settlement that was reached instead of a trial between Fox News and Dominion, They were, as you know, suing Fox for defaming the company over its work in those 2020 elections. And it's that settlement itself is just about as significant as any fully heard court case could have been. I mean, the drama was intense, and it was a cliffhanger, and you know how journalists love cliffhangers. It was held up as the two contending teams of lawyers claw and spat at each other long enough to reach a settlement. But the last minute brinkmanship on both sides, as they were both protesting so loudly that they were going to have the day in court right up to the last minute, it was kind of breathtaking. But yes, settle they did, and what a settlement it is! I think you're so right, Marshall. The main takeaway is, of course, the massive amount of money involved. Fox did not voice any kind of an apology. Except for that expressed by sheer cash. I mean, think of it as, whoops, I've done something so bad that I'm paying you more than $750,000. So, I mean, that says more than any apology could, I think. And also, in those tough last minute negotiations, Fox did finally have to say, and it did so publicly, it acknowledged that it had broadcast falsehoods. That's an admission without an apology. But the thing is, overall, in retrospect, it's easy to see that Fox would finally, eventually at least, settle. And even before the deal was done, some people were pointing out, and you yourself, Marshall, in one of our talks early on in this case, did say that settling is what Fox and its overall boss Rupert Murdoch do all the time, and that way they avoid a protracted public examination in court of the inner workings of the, I guess you can call them journal. No, you can't call them journalistic operations. Let's stop that myth now, right now. I mean, Fox concluded, we have to remember, six settlements involving the Once Upon a Time star Bill O'Reilly. Remember that when he was accused of sexual harassment, and another case, notorious case around the world, but centered in Britain, where Fox went even further. Their highest rating British Sunday tabloid, the News of the World, faced trial for hacking into prominent people's phones and voicemail. I mean, especially members of the royal family, which was particularly outraging to the British public, I think. And what did the Murdoch Empire do there? They shut the paper down, so there couldn't be a trial. So anything, it seems, to avoid a public trial, you might think, and you'd be right. One thing I guess they must be especially glad about at Fox is that they now do not have to endure their own boss being called to the witness box. The last time Rupert Murdoch had to defend his so-called journalist in public, the venue was in the UK Parliament, and it was an appearance which he said, I remember this very clearly, he said he was being very humble. It's not a word I ever heard him use ever before, but it ended up not being so much humility as a complete train wreck, as he lost it with the parliamentarians questioning him. At least we've all been spared this time around any kind of a repeat of that. But look at what we do have, even though the trial didn't go ahead. Thanks to that wonderful legal device of discovery, lawyers on the Dominion side, and thus before very long, inquiring journalists too, have had full access to the Fox people's off-the-record thinking and actions. The evidence is very clear, especially the emails and texts between themselves. It all shows that they were peddling lies, and they knew that they were peddling lies. If it had come to trial, it wouldn't have been very hard to persuade a jury that Fox was guilty of actual malice, that phrase that's so important as a legal requirement for Dominion to have won. What's very important to recognize, I think, is that Rupert, if I can be familiar with him for a moment, contributed along those same lines. because what he did have to do in preparation for this trial was sit for an affidavit, a deposition with the Dominion lawyers, and he acknowledged that the 2020 election was not stolen, along with the fact that his network's anchors kept on saying that it was. And when asked, he did want his network. Well, actually, no, they asked him, in fact, why he didn't want his network to contradict the lies. He said, and this is really important to quote verbatim, I have his words right in front of me. He said, Donald Trump had a very large following, and they were probably mostly viewers of Fox, so it would have been stupid. So there you have it in a nutshell. The picture being painted here is of Fox people running scared of saying anything that their hardcore viewers don't like. What do you describe that as? I don't know. Unedifying, perhaps? I mean, it calls for the sick bag, maybe. Let's say, anyway, at the very least, it's very, very revealing.
Revealing and not journalism. Now, what should we go? How much lower can America go in the dregs of gunshot wounds? Now it's turned into a rash, almost a plague, where somebody turns up a wrong driveway, and what doesn't matter whether they're a teenager, whether they're 8 years old, whether they're a woman who's 40 years old, people shoot first and don't ask questions. It can't get much lower than this.
You're right. I mean, I'm afraid it brings us round again to just to what seems to be an apparently insoluble situation, always pervasive and a peculiarly American one. They used to call slavery that a peculiar American institution, and it seems that gun violence is a peculiarly American institution too. I mean, I speak as a citizen as well as an immigrant. I'm not trying to pull America down, but this is something very distinctive amongst advanced economic societies the world over. America's the only one that seems to have this problem. And it's manifesting itself this week in a flurry, an extra flurry of reporting on smallish in themselves incidents that have probably been, well, we can look at the figures that have been going on at a low and not especially noted level of occurrence. But here we have three people in 1 week killed this way. And they're all cases of people aggressively guarding their homes or their cars sometimes by shooting innocent people on occasion killing them as it was in the case of in Kansas City. People a youngster just went to the wrong house or the wrong car in other cases. We now see once again our leaders wringing their hands in helplessness and talk about mental health or of limiting certain age groups from holding a gun. You know, if you're too young or if you're too old, the idea of red flag warnings for people who are likely to harm others or themselves. And yet, despite all the talk, every time, the emotions get stirred up by such terrible events. None of it gains any traction in the sense of political or legislative change. And the defend meanwhile, the defenders of Americans' freedom to bear arms, untroubled by any well-regulated control, and I use the word well-regulated advisedly, as you know. They're able to remain completely complacent, and the situation just continues.
And one final note about guns. The news broke this afternoon that prosecutors plan to dismiss charges against Alec Baldwin in that shooting on the movie set Rust. Once again, that ties into really how guns are so prevalent, even mistakes and overreaching. How prevalent guns are in our society. Where it comes down to a horrible mistake on a movie set.
Sure. Every aspect of life seems to be affected one way or another by the gun culture, or the mere physical presence of guns in places where you don't expect them, or if you do expect them, as in the case of a film set, you don't expect them to be loaded and capable of inflicting fatal damage. I mean, it's an interesting case that in this point, because it happened on a media site, in a movie site setting, we know that news about the entertainment business is always takes a high priority in much of the American journalistic media. We had big headlines because a well-known movie star was involved, and indeed charged with a very serious offense. It's interesting now that that particular part of the prosecutor's agenda has now been put to one side. The headlines have been grabbed already, I guess. And now it's the armorer solely being held responsible as the case proceeds. It's arguable how just or otherwise that might be, but we'll see as the case unfolds. But the very readiness of the media to swoop yet again and make this a headliner is significant. But however significant our reporting might be, the truth of the matter is that the overall position with Americans and their re attitude, I'm talking in really generalized terms now, is not so much of a ground shift, however horrible the things that happen are, for it to make any real difference. And of course we all know why, because the gun lobby is so well organized, even though it's going through some embarrassing moments of its own in courts of law, as we speak, over its own handling of its own finances. But we will, I mean, that particular part of the gun lobby, the National Rifle Association, in its modern incarnation, it's worth remembering that the NRA used to be very much for the responsible keeping of guns, and not a matter of having untraveled power to own and to carry. But there we have it. It's a situation that seems immovable now.
And the death of BuzzFeed, really, which was one of the few Pulitzer Prize-winning digital news services, which really grew up over the last 10 years, but they're shuttering BuzzFeed down now.
Yeah, it's a sad reflection on the reality, I suppose, the bitter reality about journalism and business. BuzzFeed tried something interesting. It went down the rabbit holes of internet life early on. It wasn't always a news organization. It began just being a kind of entertaining folding together of interesting facts, and the format they liked to fold everything into to begin with was this product of the internet age, the listicle, not quite an article, just a list of things of apparently interesting nature. But there was a limit to how much that could bring satisfaction, and certainly for the people who were running it. I kept running into them at the South by Southwest festival every year, and it was interesting to see the nature of the work change over time. And then BuzzFeed News happened, and it was an interesting piece of journalistic innovation. It brought the if you like, the digital savvy of the internet age into journalism, and there wasn't a newspaper from which it grew. It was self-generating, if you like, and it had that sort of edgy push of a good internet startup, and for a while it was kind of impressive. It concentrated in politics, which is kind of a brave thing to do. And I had quite a following, and so much so that it for some time at least seemed to be a growing and hopeful sign for journalism in the digital world. But I'm afraid the bitter truth is, as is demonstrated across the broad span of the internet, making such things monetize themselves, to use that dreadful phrase that again is another invention of the internet age, has proved well nigh impossible for them. And we're now going to find the BuzzFeed material tucked away in the sort of brother or sister organization HuffPost, which you might remember I used to be part of once upon a time. It's gone through various incarnations, and now it's yoked together with BuzzFeed. And BuzzFeed News itself will be a thing of the past, which is kind of sad. An interesting experiment, but it proves once again the difficulty of making things financially freestanding by being on the web and universally and freely available. Maybe it's another argument for if you want quality journalism, you're going to have to pay for it sometime, some way or another, if you're a discerning consumer.
Absolutely. Well, you can find David at his website, themediabeat.us. And of course, right
Free,
here.
by the way, free.
That's right. Absolutely free. And right here on Robinhood Radio. David, great to speak to you again. We'll speak to you next week.
Absolutely. Look forward to that.